from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. When you buy a computer program, part of the deal is that you promise not to give a copy of it to anyone else. It's an arrangement that's made some computer programmers and some computer companies very wealthy. But Richard Stallman says the arrangement's all wrong. Stallman's a brilliant computer programmer and the leader of a movement that says that computer programs, like ideas, should be available to all. We talk with Richard Stallman on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we talk with writer Paul Chalery about his stomping grounds, the wilderness of Yellowstone National Park. Rock critic Ken Tucker checks out the new solo album from Aaron Neville, and Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book on the last century's trendiest disease. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. British hostage John McCarthy is enjoying his first day of freedom in 5 years today, and there are strong indications that another hostage, an American, could be released soon. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
Indications that McCarthy would not be the only hostage released came from the United Nations. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said he was hopeful that an American hostage would be released in the next 24 hours. He added that he had a personal envoy in Damascus working for the release. In Kennebunkport, Maine, President George Bush said he, too, had received reports that an American would be released, but warned he had no hard information to back that up. In Damascus, after his release, John McCarthy indicated that there was hope that the hostage crisis in Lebanon might be coming to an end. In an interview on Syrian television, he said he had spoken with the leaders of Islamic Jihad, the group that held him hostage along with Terry Waite and Terry Anderson, and Islamic Jihad said the climate was right for negotiating the freedom of all those held captive in Beirut. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Perez de Cuellar cautioned today that the reported kidnapping of a Frenchman in Beirut could damage efforts to resolve the hostage problem. A previously unknown group calling itself the Organization for the Defense of Prisoners' Rights claimed to have kidnapped a man it says is a French intelligence officer. The French government claims to have no such agent, but a French medical relief organization said it did have a worker by that name. A search is now underway for the man, a 25-year-old named Jerome Leroux. The National Transportation Safety Board today released reports on the investigation of the crash of a United Airlines jet last March in Colorado Springs, killing all 25 people on board. Mark Roberts reports.
The reports show nothing that clearly points to a cause for the crash. Flight 585 was on a routine landing approach to the Colorado Springs airport when it suddenly plunged straight down into the ground. The transcript from the cockpit voice recorder showed normal operations until the final seconds when the pilots began to shout and scream, "No, no, oh my God, no." Investigators are still looking at several possibilities for the crash. First, a malfunction of the plane's rudder. Pilots flying the plane in the days before the accident report feeling an unusual movement caused by the rudder, which cleared up seconds after it happened. Weather is also suspected. Investigators think a wind rotor, a spiraling sideways wind, may have been a factor. It's been almost 6 months since the crash. NTSB investigators can usually pin down a cause for crashes like this much sooner. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts.
Stock prices slid a bit today on Wall Street after yet another unsuccessful bid to push the Dow to a new record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 13 points to close at 3,013.86. Declines edged advances in active trading of 164 million shares. This is NPR. Turkey's top military officer said today that his troops and planes have inflicted heavy losses on Turkish Kurds who've been staging guerrilla raids from hidden bases in northern Iraq. General Hürsit Tolon said that Turkish warplanes and helicopters have flown more than 130 sorties against the rebels. He said the rebels damaged at least one Turkish warplane with an anti-aircraft missile. A state judge in Miami has resigned after pleading guilty to a federal racketeering charge. Judge Roy Gelber is also agreeing to cooperate with prosecutors in a larger case. Lee Garnett of member station WSFP reports.
In court documents made public today, U.S. Attorney Dexter Layton says Operation Court Broom has been underway for more than a year and involves both state and federal agencies. The undercover phase of the investigation involved the placing of several fictitious cases with agents appearing in court as defendants. The prosecution is also using flamboyant Miami attorney Raymond Takeiff as a confidential witness. Taqif was once the chief defense lawyer for deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. The probe went public last June when state and federal agents raided the homes of Judge Gelber and four other Dade County judges. Judge Gelber now admits to extorting bribes from criminal defendants, lowering their bonds, and returning property seized by his court. For National Public Radio, this is Lee Garnett reporting.
The BCCI scandal is having an effect on Citibank and its branches in Hong Kong. Depositors in Hong Kong have been staging a run on the bank, withdrawing their money in the fear that Citibank, like BCCI, may suddenly shut down. The run was apparently triggered by comments from Senator John Dingell, who said last week that Citibank's parent corporation, Citicorp, was technically insolvent. The government's top banking regulator, William Seidman, responded to Dingell's claim by saying that Citicorp was not close to insolvency by any standard. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. Richard Stallman's been called the best computer programmer that ever lived. But these days, he's got little time to write programs. In the past decade, intellectual property law has expanded to cover software, and companies are now taking people to court who copy or change their programs. Stallman feels this stifles creativity and makes it harder to use computers, so he founded the Free Software Foundation. It's a group of like-minded, idealistic hackers who are developing their own complete software system, which they give away for free to anyone who can use it. Stallman is also crusading against copyright laws with the League for Programming Freedom. Last year, he received a genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation, which has helped to supplement the $8,000 to $10,000 he was making each year from his programming. Recently, the Free Software Foundation discovered that some hackers were vandalizing their computers. The foundation had been letting anyone freely log onto their computers and help themselves to the software. But the vandals were destroying files and using the foundation's computer as a launching point to attack other systems. Last month, the foundation reluctantly decided to limit access to their computers.
Just recently, we had to change a longstanding policy that I've followed basically as long as I've been using computers for 20 years, which was that I would always let everybody log into the computer using my account. I would never keep a password secret.
It's kind of like giving everyone the key to your home, right?
It's a little bit like that. That's the analogy that comes to everyone's mind, but there's one important difference, which is that if you leave the key to your house outside, nobody is ever going to come in except for a robber. Decent people just don't go around walking into other people's houses. But in my experience, even to this day, just about everyone who logged into my computer was friendly and considerate. And they would do it for various purposes, such as to look for software I was working on, to learn how to use the computer, to write software, to send mail to their friends. It's just a tiny minority that caused trouble. And that's what makes me sad about what happened, because in order to stop these few from deleting files on our machines, we've had to do something that's very bad for a lot of nice people.
What have you had to do? What protective measures have you had to institute?
What happened was we stopped having open accounts that everyone could log in on, and now people can only log in if they have their own accounts with their own passwords. It's as if we had a park that lots of people used, hundreds of people, and a few people started coming in and tearing it up, and so we had to put a fence around it, and now there's a gate with a watchman, and unless you have a special card, you can't get in at all.
Do you feel like, having to do what you did to institute these protective measures, that you've lost a piece of your crusade?
Yes and no. It's important to distinguish between free software and open access to our computer. The Free Software Foundation was doing this, but it's not, strictly speaking, it's not connected with developing free software. We can still do that, and we still do. But I personally feel that I've been forced to do something I'm ashamed of.
Was there ever a time, in your estimation, in computer history, when there was a free-flowing sharing of information, a real give and take?
Well, that's what I found when I got into the field around 1970. Not only the people at the main universities like MIT and Stanford, but even computer companies produced free software and this was considered natural. It wasn't even considered a special, unusual thing to do.
This was then a truly cooperative relationship at
yes.
work?
Yes. For example, there was a program originally developed by a digital equipment company, which for one operating system, I got a copy of it and made lots of improvements, made it run on a different operating system. Then people at both Beranek and Newman got that, and they made it work on another operating system and added a lot more improvements, and we kept passing it around.
Was there a sense of community then that was created around this sense of sharing and cooperation?
Well, I definitely felt it.
Is there any semblance of that community today?
Well, I've tried to create a new one. Around 1980, it pretty much died because people at universities discovered that they too could make money by not cooperating. And some of us were outraged to see what the others were doing, but we couldn't see any way to resist it. It's as if society suddenly turned into a dog-eat-dog jungle.
And what began to happen, and how did then this cooperative community become a much more competitive one?
Well, I can pinpoint it exactly. In fact, with a particular project, there was a program called Scribe developed by a student at Carnegie Mellon University. And instead of sharing it with the rest of us, as we expected, we were shocked to discover he had sold it to a company. And he's since admitted that the program probably got to be used far less as a result of that choice than it would have been if he had shared it with us as usual. But that's what he did. Everyone at MIT was shocked by this, but then people started saying, well, if it's so advantageous to be uncooperative, they started feeling tempted themselves, and a lot of people gave into the temptation.
And the temptation you're describing then is money.
Yes.
As the founder of the League of Programming Freedom, one of the things that you want to do is to remove patent and copyright laws, which you see as obstructionist.
Well, actually, that's not so. The League is not trying to remove copyright laws. Not at all.
What are you trying to do?
The League is trying to bring the interpretation of copyright laws back to the way it was a few years ago.
And then what would those laws be?
Well, a few years ago, everyone had a shared understanding of what copyright law meant in the field of software. It meant you couldn't copy the text of another person's program. But since then, the interpretation has been changed, and now copyright covers the languages that programs speak, the languages that users speak to communicate with programs. When you run a program, there are certain commands. You have to know if I type A, it will do this. If I type B, it will do that. And you have to learn these commands so that you can tell the program what you want it to do. This defines a language, a command language. Now, it's an old tradition in the field of software that people often make new programs compatible with old programs. That means they use the same commands. So if you, a user, have learned to use one program, you can go straight over to the compatible program and use that. Now, if you're a computer user, you can see why compatibility is a good thing. And that's precisely what has been made illegal by the new interpretation of copyright laws. They say that everyone who makes a program has to make it completely incompatible with everything else that exists. And this is what the League for Programming Freedom is trying to reverse.
And the result of these laws, what impact is it having then on programmers and on people that are using software?
Well, one impact it has on software is that it creates monopolies. For example, most spreadsheets that are used are compatible with 123 because users have all learned the commands of 123. Well, this means that if someone wants to make a spreadsheet, you know, we've either got to make it compatible with 123 or most users won't know how to use it and they won't be interested in it. In fact, Lotus sues anybody who makes a spreadsheet that's compatible, and as a result, nobody can do it anymore, and that leads to a monopoly or close to a monopoly for Lotus. and that leads to higher prices for users, less competition, less pressure for improvement.
So that makes then the material exclusive.
Yes. It means that the users have all learned to speak a certain language, and Lotus owns the language.
And the effect then on the consumer down at that at the home level?
The effect on them is they'll be stuck with one brand. Imagine if each brand of car had a different kind of controls. Suppose Ford had steering wheels, and General Motors had a joystick, and Chrysler had a right and left acceleration pedal like a tank. You can imagine if you learn to drive on a Ford and you go to a Chrysler, you're going to crash into something. So you'd be stuck with one brand. And this is, you can see why this is bad for all the consumers.
Another analogy you make, I believe, is to a typewriter keyboard, that what would happen is that every typewriter company would have a completely different configuration of letters.
Right. The typewriter keyboard layout is the user interface of a typewriter. So if these new kinds of copyrights were applied to typewriters, you'd get copyrighted keyboard layouts.
What do you think about the arrangement? I assume it's a kind of a cooperative arrangement between IBM and Apple. Do you see that as kind of working in your direction?
Not particularly. The main thing I think about that is that Apple is one of the companies that is suing people for writing programs that vaguely resemble Apple programs. They're trying to push their monopoly to get a monopoly broader than anything we've ever seen. They're trying to copyright a style. Imagine if Stephen King sued anybody who wrote a horror novel that read as if it might have been written by Stephen King. This would be outrageous, but that's what Apple is doing. And then you look at IBM. IBM has a gigantic number of patents, including patents on software. So they are now telling programmers that they have to get permission to write various sorts of programs because of IBM's patents. So the two of them together, I'm afraid that they could have so many monopolies that nobody else will even be allowed to try to compete with them.
And do you feel the effect of it? Do you feel like you're being shut out?
It's hard to tell. Right now, they're suing Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft. But if they win, they could sue anybody else. And definitely, in order to have a good operating system, we need to have a desktop program. And I'm afraid that anyone who makes a reasonable desktop program will get sued by Apple.
My guest is Richard Stallman. He was part of the legendary group of computer programmers at MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab in the 70s. Now he works to oppose copyright and patent laws that interfere with the development of new computer programs. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Richard Stallman. He's the founder of the Free Software Foundation, which is a charity to develop software. Also one of the founders of the League for Programming Freedom, which is a grassroots organization working to influence laws regarding patents and copyrights, also working against monopolies in computer software. Let me shift the focus here just slightly and talk to you as founder of the Free Software Society, Free Software Foundation. Is there an analogy that works for you in trying to explain to others why computer software should be free?
Well, partly it has to do with how do you live a good life. If I have a program, suppose I'm running a program and a friend comes by and says, "Hey, that's a neat program. I'd like a copy." For me, it seems shameful to say no. The Free Software Foundation aims to give computer users the freedom to copy and change the software that they use. In other words, we're trying to develop a complete system of software with which you will be able to run a computer and do what you want to do on the computer, and you'll be able to make copies of any of that software to give to your friends lawfully. And you'll be able to study how the software works and change it so that it will do exactly what you want it to do.
What makes that such a radical idea? And why is that a challenge to the kind of computer establishment?
Well, most software developers feel that they can get more money if they don't let you do these things. And so they don't. As a result, when you get an ordinary piece of commercial software, you have to make a very painful ethical decision because they make you sign a promise not to copy it. And then when your friend comes by, you either have to say, yes, you can copy it. In that case, you're breaking the promise you made. Or you have to say, no, you can't copy it, in which case you're being a bad friend. So no matter what you do, you can't win. So what I want to do is avoid getting into that position in the first place by using free software.
What do you say to a programmer who says to you, I worked hard on this, I deserve to be paid, I own this program that I created?
Well, first I'd point out that there are several assumptions hidden in that which are actually not true. One of them is that the only way to be paid to write the program is to be able to stop people from using it. Now, that's not so. The Free Software Foundation raises money. We've hired a number of staff people to write programs and write manuals. So one answer is, well, work for an organization that will raise money to pay you to write free software. But there's another answer, which I think is more an ethical answer than a practical answer, and that is, the thing that this programmer is asking to do actually wastes the value of the program that's been written. It takes the same amount of work to write a program, whether it's going to be used by 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people. And so if you only let 1,000 people use it because you give them a financial disincentive to use it, you're destroying what you've created.
When you talk about free in the Free Software Foundation, how are you using that word?
Well, the word free has two meanings in English. One has to do with no price, and the other has to do with freedom. In the term free software, I'm talking about freedom, not price. So when a program is free, it means that you, the user, have the freedom to make copies, the freedom to study it and change it and improve it. But it doesn't say anything about whether you pay money to get it. You might get it without paying money, or you might pay money to get it. And the Free Software Foundation, we distribute software in two ways. We put copies on the computer nets, and people can copy that, and they don't have to pay anything. Or they can send us money, and we'll mail them tapes. And that's how we raise most of our money.
My guest has been computer hacker Richard Stallman. If you think stress is a new condition, there's a book by Tom Lutz called American Nervousness that presents evidence to the contrary. Lutz says Americans have been feeling overwhelmed by stress since the Civil War. Only then the condition was diagnosed as neurasthenia. At the turn of the century, when Freud was writing about hysteria in Europe, an epidemic of the disease raged among artists, intellectuals, and politicians in this country. Critic Maureen Cargan says that reading American Nervousness is in itself a nerve-wracking experience.
These days, anybody in America can be stressed out. It's a democratic disorder. But back in the early 1900s, you really had to be somebody special to be diagnosed as nervous or neurasthenic. The list of sufferers Tom Lutz compiles in American Nervousness reads like a turn-of-the-century People magazine profile. Edith Wharton, Fanny Farmer, Theodore Dreiser, Emma Goldman, Gertrude Stein, and Thomas Aikens were all neurasthenic at one time in their lives. That snob, Henry James, was neurasthenic while the disease was fashionable, but when too many Americans began to feel jittery, James snapped out of it. Like the Epstein-Barr virus, or yuppie flu, that first appeared in the 1970s, neurasthenia was chiefly characterized by exhaustion. But the other symptoms were so murky, it's no wonder that anybody with the money and leisure time to be sick thought they had the disorder. People were diagnosed as neurasthenic if they suffered from insomnia, asthma, baldness, drunkenness, or something called brain collapse. The physician, George Beard, who was known as the father of neurasthenia, tried to cure his patients by zapping them with electricity to replenish vital nerve energy. For those who preferred do-it-yourself treatments, the Heidelberg Electric Belt with genital attachments was advertised in the 1903 Sears catalog for $18. Neurasthenia and its quaint cures are easy to laugh at. But Tom Lutz argues that the neurasthenia epidemic of the early 1900s should be taken seriously because of who it struck: upper-class people who were the caretakers of the culture. Again, like the yuppie flu, neurasthenia may have been triggered by the way a certain group of people were living and thinking. Lutz says that the upper-class victims of neurasthenia were anxious about cultural changes like feminism, the influx of immigrants, and the advent of the consumer society. In other words, the dawning of the modern world gave the upper classes a massive identity crisis. The cures for neurasthenia, apart from quack gizmos like the Heidelberg belt, usually entailed returning the patient to a more secure, old-fashioned way of life. For instance, neurasthenia specialist Dr. S. Weir Mitchell sent male patients like Teddy Roosevelt and Frederick Remington to the Dakotas for exercise cures. Not so different from the wild man weekends some men pay to go on today. Meanwhile, female neurasthenics were prescribed bed rest and treated like infants. But one of these patients, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, got her revenge when she portrayed Mitchell as a diabolical jailer in her famous short story, The Yellow Wallpaper. The most fascinating part of Lutz's book is when he demonstrates how neurasthenia shaped the conservative thinking of some of its victims. Lutz says that Teddy Roosevelt learned to speak more softly and to work more strenuously during his time on the ranches. Thus, from nervousness and its cure was born the rough-riding ethos Roosevelt would translate into a vigorous and imperialist foreign policy. Unfortunately, Lutz's argument isn't always this clear. Every so often, a rash of words like post-liminal and multiversal erupts in his paragraphs. And his anecdotal history of neurasthenia jumps around so skittishly, you wonder if he's sympathetically contracted the disease he's writing about. American nervousness has a lot of smart things to say about the interaction of disease and culture. But a few jolts from the old Heidelberg belt might have done Lutz's writing style a world of good.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air.
I'm filling in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. 3 years ago, the world watched fires roar across Yellowstone National Park. To many, that was a disaster, but to writer and Yellowstone resident Paul Schilleri, the fire was just a part of nature. Coming up, Paul Schilleri tells us about the real threat to his home, development. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Warm Your Heart, the new solo album from Aaron Neville. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. While church bells rang in London today for the release of hostage John McCarthy, another claim of a kidnapping was made in Beirut. McCarthy was set free after more than 5 years held as a hostage in Lebanon. He said that his captors are seeking a full exchange of Western hostages and Israeli Arab prisoners. In Beirut, an underground group claimed that it kidnapped a French relief worker and warned that he would be killed if other Western hostages are set free. McCarthy told reporters today that he had seen Americans Terry Anderson and Thomas Sutherland recently, and they appeared to be in good health and in good spirits. John McCarthy is expected to meet this weekend with UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar in Europe. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
McCarthy told reporters today that his Islamic kidnappers had asked him to convey a letter to Perez de Cuellar. He is expected to do so sometime this weekend when he meets with the Secretary General in Europe. McCarthy said he didn't know what was in the letter, but he believes it is an appeal to Perez de Cuellar to help secure the release of Arab prisoners in Israeli jails. In New York today, the Secretary General suggested he would try to cooperate with such a request.
No, I think that we have to consider that is the beginning of a process leading to the release of all hostages, all hostages.
Perez de Cuellar said he is optimistic another hostage would be set free soon, but he said the purported kidnapping today of a French medical worker in Beirut wouldn't help his negotiation efforts. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Israeli officials say that they will release Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners if Israeli soldiers held in Lebanon are included in any exchange of hostages. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Ori Lubrani, Israel's coordinator in South Lebanon, said the only obstacle to a comprehensive prisoner swap is the issue of the Israeli soldiers. He said if Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah were ready to release the missing seven Israeli soldiers, Israel would release all Palestinians captured in Lebanon and Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. Israel's most prominent prisoner is Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid, a Shiite Muslim cleric who Israel kidnapped 2 years ago. Lubrani said it was still not clear whether the Islamic Jihad is willing to include the Israelis in any prisoner deal. Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said Israel wants the Red Cross to visit the seven Israeli soldiers taken prisoner in Lebanon between 1982 and 1986. Israel also wants proof that they are alive before negotiations begin. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 13 points to close at 3,013.86 on volume of some 164 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. The Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe is holding a two-day meeting to try and work out a way to end the current unrest in Yugoslavia. The leader of Yugoslavia's delegation says that his government is still opposed to armed outside intervention in Croatia and hopes that a shaky ceasefire will hold. France has called for a European military force to move into the breakaway republic, but Moscow is warned against this, saying it could lead to an all-European conflict. The Attorney General of the state of Louisiana has started the appeals process on a federal judge's ruling yesterday that overturned the state's tough anti-abortion law. The case is expected to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Bill Zeebel of member station WWNO has more on the story.
William Gust filed the appeal today with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. This is standard legal procedure, and it could be months before the circuit court takes up the case. But Gust's appeal stresses concern for saving the lives of unborn children, and therefore he hopes his appeal will completely bypass the circuit court. That seems unlikely. experts feel Pennsylvania's anti-abortion law has a better chance of reaching the Supreme Court before Louisiana's. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in New Orleans.
At the PGA Championship in Carmel, Indiana, a man has been killed by lightning. Officials say that a spectator was struck while walking in a car park after the tournament was suspended for a time by the threat of lightning during a thunderstorm. It was the second death caused by lightning this year at a major golf championship. And the Department of Transportation says that it has ended all air sanctions against South Africa and will consider applications from air carriers for service there. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up strongly. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 3 years ago, fires raged in Yellowstone National Park. At first, they were allowed to burn, a decision that sparked a public debate. On one side of the issue are those who believe a let-it-burn policy is healthy for the forest. On the other side are those who, for a variety of reasons, believe firefighters should intervene. Forest fires is one of the many issues that Paul Schilleri writes about. Schilleri lives in Yellowstone, where he's a technical writer for the National Park Service. He's also an essayist and a naturalist. A new collection of his essays called Pregnant Bears and Crawdad Eyes have just been published. He joins us today from his home in the park. Paul Schilleri, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
How much has Yellowstone been changed from the fires of 3 summers ago?
Well, I suppose visually it's been changed a great deal. It's going to be a long time before the great green vistas that were here before 1988 have restored themselves in substantial parts of the park. About a third of the park was affected in some way or other by fire. And I have to say affected rather than burned, because it wasn't all just blackened. There are a variety of kinds of forest fires, and the big crown fires, as they call them, that just blacken all the trees, probably hit about a sixth of the park. So as you drive through the park, you'll pass through extensive burns, and they are big, and then you'll pass through areas that aren't burned. It's what the ecologists call a mosaic, and the ecologists make a big point of that mosaic providing the diversity of habitats that gives the diversity of life forms Yellowstone has. I guess that's sort of the center of their argument in favor of fire.
That means someone traveling through the park will see burned tree stumps and other evidence of a real fire that's been there.
They'll see standing burned forests. They'll pass through areas sometimes as much as a mile long, maybe in some places it's longer, I'd have to think for a minute, where the trees are still standing. In a natural situation, when those trees burn, it will take 30 or 40 years for all of them that are actually dead to fall. Within the first year, you start to see green up on the forest floor. Depending on the soils and the vegetation that was there before and how much moisture you happen to get, that regrowth will be very slow, or it will be very fast. Someplace the regrowth has just been fabulous.
The controversy about whether to let the fires burn or put them out, was that settled to your satisfaction?
It's still going on, and so far it looks to me like, though it's winding along the way controversies do, often kind of slowly, it looks like it's working out so that it could be for the best of the ecological processes here, which is to say that it looks like before long we will once again be allowing at least some fires to burn. And I happen to think that's the right thing, and so I guess my answer is yes.
I think for some segments of the population, a fire is inevitably going to burn animals alive. And the question that people have is, how can other people stand by and allow animals to die?
That sort of thing reaches right to the heart of all of us. It's the same sort of thing as having a wilderness system. A place like Yellowstone, which is largely wilderness with a small W, where predators go out. You know, it's very hard the first time you see it to watch a grizzly bear take down an elk or an elk calf. But then the next minute, here come two or three grizzly bear cubs, and they are just magnificently cute animals, out of the woods for dinner. You know, that's a very complicated thing. And fire is pretty much the same way. Those fires even if we could have stopped them in 1988, were the primary regenerative force in the Yellowstone area for thousands of years. The animals that live here have been living with those fires for a long time. But I suppose more directly to answer your question is that not all that many die. It's true that some do, especially certain kinds of small mammals. The small mammals that, say, burrow in the ground as their method of defense, most of those probably made it. The soil doesn't get heated that deeply. They're more at risk from loss of oxygen. But the animals who are conditioned to run into a tree to hide, well, that's not the right place to go.
Are there animals that are conditioned to escape fire?
Anything that can fly will, of course. And the large mammals, which were the ones that sort of evoked the most concern in the public here during the fires, the large mammals just step aside. It was really impressive here, and a big surprise, I think, even to a lot of the biologists who work in the park and work in other similar areas, to see how calmly the elk and the bison and the other large mammals seem to take the fires. There are any number of photographs of elk out grazing in a meadow, bedded down in a meadow, while 100 yards away the forest is just raging, just all burning. They got very good at being able to do that. They weren't always successful, and it's important to be realistic about this. Fires do kill animals. The cases in the park where we actually found animals killed by these fires, especially the large animals, were where a fire was moving very fast, being pushed by high winds across a broad front, and the animals could not, literally could not, step aside. And in most cases then, what we found was that the fires, apparently pushing smoke ahead of them, suffocated the animals before they burned them. Of maybe 30,000 elk that live in Yellowstone in the summer, around 300 were found after the fires.
You have an essay in your book. I don't know whether you truly mean to blame it all on Bambi, but that's certainly how you begin your essay. And of course, you're talking about the movie, the Disney version of Bambi, this image of a fire devouring a forest and destroying everything in its path. You also say in this essay that Bambi teaches some pretty lousy ecology. Can you explain?
Yes, I think I know that Bambi taught me and taught many of my colleagues that fires kill everything and that fire is simply bad. Fire is a supernatural monster. And as we found here, and as the fire ecologists who had been studying this place for years before the fires had been telling us, fire is just part of the wilderness process here. It's a violent part. I think Bambi is one of the most beautiful animated movies ever made, and some of the most powerful sequences in it are those fire scenes. And that is the reaction you have when you see real fire. It's just an overwhelming thing. When you see a 200-foot-tall tree torch all at once and just light up and almost explode, it's shocking. It's stunning. But whether or not that's bad for Bambi and Bambi's little friends, and more important, for the population of Bambis that are out there and have been living in that forest for thousands of years, is another question.
I'm speaking today with Paul Schilleri. He lives in Yellowstone National Park. And a collection of his essays called Pregnant Bears and Crawdad Eyes has just been published. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Schilleri is my guest. He's a writer, essayist, and naturalist, and he lives in Yellowstone National Park. How close have you ever been to a grizzly bear? Or a bear at all?
Oh, I suppose in the wild, if you spend much time here, you end up with the feeling that you were probably a lot closer than you thought, and the bear just let you go by. You know, they're very good at sort of watching you. I haven't been as close as many. I doubt that I've been closer than 50 yards to a grizzly bear out in the wild. Now, near a developed area or something like that, where a bear is hanging around near a hotel or something like that, and I happen to be in a car observing the bear, I've been a lot closer. I've had them walk right by my car door. That's pretty exciting.
You say there's something about bears that inspires a kind of mixture of fear and exhilaration.
There is. For example, back in the 70s, before the last small garbage dumps were closed around Yellowstone, I was one of the rangers who was monitoring grizzly bear use at one of these little dumps. We were going in every night after dark and identifying the individuals to see how many were using or were dependent upon that garbage. And to sit there in the absolute dark and have an adult grizzly bear suddenly loom up above the hood of your car and look through the windshield at you inspires all sorts of things, I assure you.
You want to be more specific?
Well, you don't feel like your Audubon Society membership is much protection at that point. You know?
Well, are bears any more a threat to visitors to the park than any other animal? I mean, any other animal that has big teeth and nails?
No, the animal that injures the most people in Yellowstone these days is the bison. Far more injuries from bison than from bears.
Are these bison, what, that attack people?
Well, what happens, this is one of the points that I hope I'm making in that book, that we've gotten ourselves removed enough from these animals that when we actually do see them in something like a natural setting, we hardly know what to do. And Yellowstone, to many people coming from urban areas, looks a lot like a wild animal park, a tame animal park. And these bison that are grazing along the roads are by no means tame. They're just a little more used to seeing people, so they don't run around and run away when the people come up. Routinely, what happens here a lot is that a person will get out of their car and they're conditioned, this is my theory on this, they're conditioned by the wonderful photography in the Nature magazine and by all the wonderful photography on the nature programs on television to want to fill the frame of their camera with that animal. You know, they don't realize that the people who were shooting all of those beautiful photographs were using telescopes and telephoto lenses the sizes of a cruise missile. You know, they have tremendous big lenses. And so they get really close. People will walk right up to a bison. A bull bison weighs a ton. It can run 30 miles an hour. And if it wants you, it has you. And every now and then, somebody will get too close, and finally something will snap in that marvelous prehistoric bovine mind, and the bison will feel threatened. And if the person's only 3 feet away, the bison may very casually just flip that big head toward the person and put a big hole in the person with its horn. So we're always passing out leaflets to people, stay back, stay back. I guess they look a lot like cows.
How much traffic or even public interest can the park withstand before it becomes something else, before it becomes, I guess, a theme park?
We're still figuring out how much effect people have here. People have had a huge effect. This place has had more than 100 million visitors now in the last century. And we've got hundreds of miles of roads, more than 1,000 miles of maintained trails. And as I say, every year, 2 to 3 million people come here. They generate a lot of garbage, sewage, law enforcement situations, all sorts of things go on here. So we're not talking about something that has ever, since it was established, been perfectly primitive, or that the managers have ever thought should be perfectly primitive. It really is a question of how much you dare risk. My own view of it is that, at best, we are dangerously close to losing important things. The universal view, I think, among the scientists these days about the grizzly bear, for example, is that these days in Yellowstone and in the surrounding country, the grizzly bear's doing pretty well. Grizzly bears are very good at making more grizzly bears if we give them the room to do that. But the long-term prospects, say 30 or 40 or 50 years, are really gloomy, because more and more people want to enjoy not just the park, but the country around it, what's called the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. There's more and more development, timber harvest, all of those things that people have a perfect right to do, but that cumulatively are changing what Yellowstone is.
How long have you lived in the park?
I've been here about 3 years this time. I first lived here in 72. I worked here in the 70s as a ranger naturalist for several years.
What's your view out your window?
My view out my window, in the foreground, I live in a small building that's actually an apartment building. It has about, I guess, a dozen different apartments in it. In the foreground, there's a little lane that's shaded by some evergreen trees. There's a dumpster, very urban sort of thing, except this is a dumpster unlike any you've ever seen because it's bear-proof. It has a funny little turrets sticking up on top that bears are unable to figure out how to open and reach into.
Yet.
Then there's a hill that drops off down to a river valley, and about a mile to the east, there's a long, beautiful mountain with a lot of lodgepole pine trees on top and open bare slopes on the bottom. It's a very steep slope.
Would you trade that view for anything else?
No. Nothing I've seen, anyway.
Paul Chaleri, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Paul Chaleri lives in Yellowstone National Park. His book is called Pregnant Bears and Crawdad Eyes. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. We'll visit tonight the Techwood Homes neighborhood of Atlanta, Georgia. That city is getting ready for the 1996 Summer Olympic Games, and there's now pressure to do something about Techwood. It's the country's first public housing project, and there's quite a bit of crime and drug dealing there. Techwood is close to many of the Olympic venues. The questions are, should it be torn down or revitalized or left alone? We are assured by the city officials in Atlanta that the residents of Techwood will be the ones to decide what will eventually happen. At the moment, many of those residents seem to trust the city is telling the truth.
Okay. Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most people know of Aaron Neville as the distinctly high voice on Neville Brothers songs. The band's become more popular outside of their native New Orleans over the past several years. Aaron Neville's got a new album of his own, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. From the album, here's a song that may be familiar.
Everybody plays the fool sometimes. There's no exception to the rule. Listen, baby, it may be factual, it may be cruel.
Aaron Neville's first solo album in more than a decade was produced by Linda Ronstadt, and as such, it represents both a meeting of minds and a difference in sensibilities. Neville's recent records with the Neville Brothers were odd paradoxes, dense slabs of rhythm and blues filled with earnest, topical lyrics. But the music was strained. This was the sound of aging pop musicians anxious for a hit. By contrast, Ronstadt has overseen Warm Your Heart with the calculated dispassion that Peter Asher brought to her greatest records in the 70s. The result is a brisk pop album that at its worst is superficial, but at its best is beautiful, sexy, and powerful.
Don't go, please stay. Don't go. If I call out your name like a prayer, would you lead me along with my tears, knowing I need you so? Would you still turn and go? But this time, be different in some way. Don't go, please stay. Don't go, please stay. You took me away from the rest of the world when you taught me to love you like this. Now I hang by a thread in the canyon of doom, but I still can be saved. by your kiss. If I call out your name like a prayer.
Having Neville sing that old Burt Bacharach song is the high point of Linda Ronstadt's inspiration here. It's a terrific song, not one you'd ever expect to hear Neville sing, and he does it with offhanded mastery. But there are also more than a few clinkers here.
Ave Maria. Grazia plena. Maria, grazia plena. Maria, grazia plena. Ave, ave Dominus, Dominus tecum.
Asking Aaron Neville to sing Ave Maria is one of Ronstadt's more obvious attempts to suck up to high culture. Neville gives a performance as stiff as the one Ronstadt gave when she tried to do Gilbert and Sullivan some years ago. And Aaron Neville singing Jimmy Buffett is not my idea of a good time, and I like to think it's not Neville's either, and that's why he sounds so halting and vague on the Buffett tune that's included here. On the other hand, Aaron Neville gliding through Warm Your Heart, a 60s chestnut written by the Atlantic Records trio of Tom Dowd, Jerry Wexler, and Ahmet Erdogan, and accompanied by Dr. John on piano, is my very definition of a good time.
Well, we're all searching for peace of mind. Love in this world is hard to find. Come close to me. Hold my hand and warm your heart.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. Let us know what you think about Fresh Air by calling our listener response line 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Marty Moscowain.
And warm your heart. Well, you're the reason for the way I'm feeling.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we meet writer Ben Hamper. He put in 11 years as a shop rat on the assembly line at General Motors. Those years are the subject of his new book, Rivethead. I'm Marty Moscowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.